In today's story, we are going back to 1886 and uncovering the truth behind the first execution of a female prisoner that took place within Strangeways Prison, Manchester. Born in Oldham during 1847, Mary Ann Haig was the second eldest daughter of Joseph and Hannah Haig. Joseph and Hannah married on the 22nd of February 1846 and they had three children. Along with Mary, they also had Emma, who was born in 1846, and Thomas, who was born in 1848. Joseph sadly died just 1 year after Mary's birth, but that wouldn't stop her mother from going on to having two other children by the names of Hannah and Jane to a man called John Yates, who she would marry in January 1856. During 1851, Mary lived at number 45 Hemshaw Street, Ashton-under-Lyne, with her mother Hannah, with both her sister Emma and brother Thomas. Several years passed by, and on the 24th of January 1866, when, at the age of 19, Mary married Thomas Britland, who was 5 years her senior at St Michael's in Ashton-under-Lyne, and in December of that year they would welcome their first daughter into the family as Mary gave birth to Elizabeth. 2 years later, and Mary and Thomas would welcome another addition into their family as Mary gave birth to Susanna in December 1868. Now, at some point during 1871, Mary and her family all lived at number 25 Park Bridge, Ashton-under-Lyne, which they now shared with her mother and half-sister Hannah Yates. It was at some point around 1885 that Mary and her family all moved to 133 Turner Lane, Ashton-under-Lyne, and they soon settled in, making good friends with their local residents, but it may have been too good if the rumours that surrounded Mary are to be believed. At this time, Mary and Elizabeth had started to work at Fisher & Jackson, Lees Street Mill, and Thomas was a cart driver who also worked as a barman in the Heaps Folds Old Street. Not too long after settling in their rented accommodation, Mary had begun to strike up a close relationship with her neighbours Thomas and Mary Dixon, with whom she was often seen with. They spent a lot of time in each other's company, and according to newspaper reports covering the case, it seemed Thomas Dixon was never away from the Britlands' house, and this had led to several arguments between Thomas Britland and Mary, often within earshot of their daughter Elizabeth. Now, what we don't know for sure is if Mary and Thomas were indeed seeing each other behind their partners' backs, as was many people's suspicions. But what is certain is that something seriously went wrong with her relationship with her first daughter, Elizabeth. And on Monday the 8th of March 1886, Elizabeth had been spending the evening with her fiancé, a man named William Davis, and all seemed fine. It was later into the night when she would start to complain of excruciating pain in her stomach, which led to extreme vomiting and diarrhoea. This would last well into the following morning until around 10 a.m. when Dr. Thompson would be called for. When he arrived to see Elizabeth, he was told that she had suffered a fit during the night, but that she was now feeling a little better. But not sure what to make of this, Dr. Thompson made out a prescription and seemingly left. Another witness who was present throughout the day would go on to say that Elizabeth had moments of seizures and her hands and legs would be constantly twitching. Whilst Elizabeth was struggling through all of this, it was around 11 a.m. that morning when Mary visited a chemist by the name of Hurst, and she went on to purchase a packet of Harrison's vermin powder, saying that she was having problems back at home with mice. Now, it's a bit odd, wouldn't you say? Her daughter is having a rough time of things, and all Mary can think about is nipping down to the local chemist for rat poison. It was reported that people who lived on Turner Lane had indeed issues with vermin, and the chemist was always selling poison to the vast majority of residents who lived there. But to visit when your child is seriously ill doesn't seem quite right. But I digress, and as the day went on, Elizabeth would continue to suffer, and she complained of pains to her legs and to the left-hand side of her body. She would also continue having violent seizures and with twitching to her hands and feet. It was around 8 p.m. on the 9th of March Elizabeth would sadly pass away. Now, one could assume Elizabeth had found out about her mother's intimacy with Thomas, and perhaps threatened to tell her father and possibly Thomas's wife, to which Mary then tried to silence her. It seems extremely strange though, as both her and Elizabeth had a strong relationship, or so it seemed. The following day, Mary visited the Prudential Assurance Company and received a payment for life insurance on Elizabeth, which resulted in the sum of £10. Now, obviously, the death of Elizabeth came as somewhat of a shock and surprise, and because she was a young lady seemingly with no health issues prior to her death, an autopsy was performed, but nothing could account for her death. However, parts of her insides were kept for further analysis, which will prove to be Mary's undoing at a later date. A little over a month later, and on the 30th of April, Mary visited Mrs. Mortimer. Now, she was the wife of an agent who worked for the Prudential Assurance Company, and she paid her the sum of 1 shilling 8 pence, and that was insurance money for her husband Thomas, which would insure him for the total of around £11.17. Now, this was an extremely strange thing for anybody to do, and something which had never been done before. As the usual way this would work is for the insurance agent to visit the person at their own home and to collect the money themselves. In fact, it was so strange, Mrs. Mortimer apparently asked Mary why she had decided to bring the money to her, and Mary's reply was, "I want this money to be paid because I will be away this Saturday." On the same day, but later on in the afternoon and after all the mills had closed, Mary waited outside the gates of Holmes Mill for a woman named Hadfield and asked if she would go with her to Kilvington's, another chemist in Ashton, to go and buy some mouse powder, as they had mice who had gotten into all their flannels, or so she said. Both women made their way, and Mary purchased a packet of Hunter's vermin powder, which would cost her 3 pence. On the 1st of May, Mary's husband Thomas was working at Heap's Vaults and was in good health, but when he returned home later that evening, his health deteriorated very quickly. So fast that by 10 o'clock the following morning, an assistant surgeon was called by the name of Tucker. What he saw was Thomas dying, and he had all the same symptoms that Elizabeth had shown when she died only a month prior. Towards 6 o'clock in the evening, Thomas seemed to perk up a little, and over the course of the weekend, things started to seem normal again. However, he had been alone with Mary all this time, and by Monday morning, the 3rd of May, and at around 10 o'clock, Mary went to visit Hersey's chemist, where she purchased a further 3 packets of Harrison's vermin killer. While she was in the chemist, a man named Waterhouse was present, and Mary had asked him to be witness to her purchase. At the same time, he joked with her, "Mind you administer them in a scientific way, not in too large doses, and you will get the club money." Mary laughed, replying, "Oh man, you do not propose for God's sake that I would do that." Later that evening, Thomas would be taken very ill again. He would suffer terrible seizures and fits, his hands would clench and all his muscles would go into spasms. Sometime around 10 o'clock that morning, Thomas Dixon was called for, and 45 minutes later, at 10:45 a.m, Thomas Britland would be dead. Now, 2 deaths, both family members, and both dying within a short few weeks of each other and seemingly suffering from the same symptoms, well, you could say tongues would soon begin to wag. What came next, though, would be bizarre, as both Mary and Thomas Dixon would take a cab into Mosley on the same evening her husband died, on the 3rd of May, to go and claim Thomas Britland's club money. Now, Thomas was a member of the Independent Order of Odd Fellows, along with his brother John. They visited John, who they then informed of his brother's death. He also agreed to take Mary and Thomas Dixon to the secretary of the lodge, but they could not draw the money as they needed a registrar's certificate of death. Mary and Thomas Dixon both returned back to Ashton, where they got out of the cab on Henrietta Street so they wouldn't be seen and to stop people talking. The next day, Mary collected Thomas Britland's insurance money from the Prudential Assurance Company. That would be around £11.17, and she and Dixon went back to Mosley to collect his club money, which was in total around £8. That same day, a lady named Mary Ann Talent was at the home of Mary and was cleaning the house, preparing it for the funeral of Thomas. She would later testify in court that at no time ever did she ever encounter any evidence of mice being present. A day after the death of Thomas Britland, the Dixons welcomed Mary into their home, and on the 9th of May, both Mary and Thomas Dixon both visited John Arthur Butterworth's hat shop, as 2 months prior, Thomas Britland had purchased a hat for himself. Taking the hat back, Mary wanted it changing so it fitted Thomas Dixon, and they paid 5 shillings to do so. As for Thomas Britland, well, his autopsy was done, and just like in the case of Elizabeth, there was nothing untoward found. And just like in Elizabeth's case, his internal organs would be kept for further analysis, which again would go some way to implicating Mary in his death. At 10 p.m. on the 13th of May, Mary would have supper with the Dixons, which consisted of bread and butter and cheese and pickles. Both the Dixons went off to bed later that evening, sleeping in the back room, whilst Mary slept in the front room with Mrs. Dixon's sister, Selina Wolfenden. Shortly after midnight, Mary Dixon would become violently ill, and hearing a commotion coming from Mrs. Dixon's room, Mary apparently ran into the room, finding Mrs. Dixon clenching onto the bed frame and shaking all over. Mary would shortly go downstairs to prepare a pot of tea, whilst Thomas Dixon was bringing the tea back up to the bedroom, Mary would go and fetch some flannels. At 1 o'clock in the morning, Dr. Thompson was called for, and he gave medication before leaving the house. Unfortunately, Mary Dixon's condition went worse, and at around 6 a.m. that morning, she passed away. The following day, Mary went to the insurance company and collected on behalf of Thomas Dixon the sum of around £19.17, signing off the certificate of identity. So as you can imagine, and with another death surrounding Mary Ann Britland, tongues had started to wag again. but this time it wouldn't be long before news got back to the police. Chief Constable Dag Lees took possession of the Dixons' house, and it was decided that a post-mortem of the body should be made and a coroner's inquest should be opened. Now this is where things start to get a little strange. On the 15th of May, Mary visited Mr. Law, the keeper of a coffee house, and asked if it would be okay for her to supply the tea at the funeral of the Dixons. Mr. Law didn't have any objections to this, as weird as that may seem. Whilst there, Mary asked many strange questions relating to poison and could it be found out if somebody had been poisoned. She asked Mr. Law, can they tell if a person has been poisoned? And, can you tell if they had mouse powder? When Mr. Law answered yes to both questions, she then asked if they could tell if it had been in their tea, to which Mr. Law answered yes again. Just by chance, another woman by the name of Mrs. Dixon, and yes or no, it's getting a little confusing now, but she was also in the coffee house and overheard the conversation between Mary and Mr. Law. Now, Mrs. Dixon is quoted as saying to Mary, or Mrs. Britland, do not talk like that, it makes one suspicious. Now, the results of Mary Dixon's post-mortem would, just like that of Elizabeth and Thomas Britland, come back inconclusive, with no evidence of foul play. However, this wouldn't stop the police from digging around, and on Tuesday the 25th of May, Mary would be arrested and charged with the murder of Mary Dixon, and Thomas Dixon being charged with an accessory to murder. On Wednesday the 26th of May, both Mary and Thomas would be called up in front of the magistrates, and Chief Constable Dag Lees would state that he felt Mary could be responsible for the deaths of her husband, Thomas, as well as her daughter Elizabeth, and a request to the Home Office asking for exhumation of both bodies for further testing was applied for. Thomas Dixon shortly afterwards made a statement detailing the events, in quite some detail, of the moments leading up to and after the deaths of Elizabeth, Thomas and his wife Mary. He explained the similarities in all three cases. Now some may argue he did this to possibly save his own skin, as he was complicit in all three deaths, but then again, he may well have been innocent all along. On the 19th of June, and having spent the last 2 weeks on remand in jail, Mary and Thomas were again brought up to face the magistrates. Both would hear that Mary's daughter's body, along with her husband's body, had been exhumed and further tests had been conducted to prove if the existence of poison had indeed participated in their deaths. As the results still hadn't come back, Chief Constable Dag Lees asked for Mary and Thomas to remain on remand until they arrived. Both were accordingly placed on remand for a further week. Another week went past, and once again they both appeared back in court on Wednesday the 23rd of June. The court was crowded with many people, all eager to hear the updates of the case. Chief Constable Dag Lees was still awaiting the results of the tests, and again asked for both Mary and Thomas to remain on remand. After a long discussion, the magistrates agreed to postpone further appearances until 29th of June. So 6 days later, on the 29th, they both appeared back in court, and this time the reports of the results from both bodies was heard. Mr. Charles Escort, public analyst for the City of Manchester, concluded that he found no traces of strychnia, but arsenic was present in the body. Dr. Harris was recalled and stated that strychnia was a chemical that was absorbed very quickly by the body and which was also eliminated just as quick once ingested. Therefore, he said that what they needed to do was look at all the evidence of the effects of the strychnia had on the body of those affected prior to their death. He also stated that it would not be a surprise to find arsenic in the body of the deceased, as this isn't easily absorbed. Based on these witness testimonies, the case was adjourned until Wednesday, 14th of July. So here we go on to the Wednesday, and both Mary Ann Britland and Thomas Dixon were brought before the magistrates, once again to face charges of murdering Mary Dixon and Thomas Britland. Curiously though, no charges were brought against them for the murder of Elizabeth Britland, Mary's daughter. Even more strange was the opening statement from the Mayor, Mr. Alderman Walker, who said, Thomas Dixon, the magistrates have had a great deal of trouble considering your case. We have studied the law with the advice of the clerk to see whether you are an accessory before or after the fact. And after due consideration, we may say that the magistrates do not think that there is sufficient evidence to incriminate you at present. But in discharging you, I may say it does not relieve you if further evidence transpires to put you upon trial. The same as if we had committed you today. At present, you'll be discharged. So as it was, Thomas Dixon would walk away from any further trials, but Murray wouldn't be so lucky. The magistrates would charge her with having, on the 14th of May, killed and murdered one Mary Dixon. She was also charged with having, on the 3rd day of May, having killed her husband, Thomas Britland. Thomas Dixon would be driven away from the court in a cab, whereas Mary, who had at this point maintained a strong demeanour ever since being arrested, well, she just broke down and had to be assisted by two police officers on her way down to the cells. The day of Mary's trial was one of commotion, as many people arrived all wanting to see what fate beheld the now named Ashton Poisoner. On Thursday, 22nd of July, she appeared in court to face charges of murdering her husband, Thomas Britland, and also Mary Dixon, the wife of Thomas Dixon. But because of the similarity of both those deaths compared with that of her daughter Elizabeth's, the coroner asked that she also be charged with the murder of Elizabeth. Neatly dressed and remaining calm throughout the proceedings, Mary listened intently to all the evidence and testimonies put before her. On Friday, the 23rd of July, and into the second day of her trial, Sergeant Nightingale would testify that on the 9th of July, when he was conveying the prisoner from jail to the police courts, she asked him if Thomas Dixon would get off, to which he replied that some people think he would. Mary replied, "He has no right to get off, and he would not if I could tell my mind. He ought to be locked up all the while the same as me. It was him that led me into it, and he wanted me to go away before I was locked up, and he would go with me when the bother was over. He won't get off if I can tell my mind. I have nothing to go away for, and if I went away, people would think I am guilty, whether I am or not." The trial would only last the Thursday and the Friday, and to make things even worse or stranger for Mary was the fact that no witnesses who could defend her were ever brought up to the stand. It was also stated by Mr. Blair that no motive for the alleged crimes had ever been shown to exist. So the judge left two questions for the jury to ponder over. The first being, did Mary Dixon die of poisoning? With the second being, if she did, was it administered by Mary? The jury would deliberate for 4 hours before reaching their final verdicts of willful murder. Mary, on being asked what she had to say, replied, "I am not guilty, sir. I am not guilty. I am quite innocent, sir. I am not guilty at all." The judge proceeded to put on his black cap before committing Mary to the death penalty. Mary's demeanour completely gave way at the judge's ruling as she begged for mercy. She would have to be eventually carried away by two female wardens as she shrieked to the people sat within the gallery. On Monday, the 9th of August 1886, Mary Ann Britland was executed within the walls of Strangeways Prison, shortly after 8 o'clock in the morning. She had longed for a reprieve, since the guilty verdict was placed upon her, but when the Home Office contacted her declining any help in the matter, she began to prepare herself for the end. Worn and thin, her physical appearance was a marked difference from that of only 2 weeks prior, when she was in court. The sleepless nights and lack of food had transformed this once confident woman into nothing more than a shell of a human. As she made her way to the gallows, James Berry, the executioner, had been waiting, standing close by to the rope which she would soon be hanging from. She began crying in despair, saying, "Oh God forgive me," and "Lord have mercy upon my soul." Two female warders guided her to the drop, where they were accompanied by two male wardens who held her in place whilst Berry quickly placed a white hood over Mary's head, before fixing the noose around her neck. Raising his left hand as a sign for the wardens to leave, his right hand soon pulled on the lever as Mary fell around 7 feet to her death. Mary was the first female to be executed within the walls of Strangeways Prison, and as with most executions at the time, she was left to hang for around an hour before her body was taken down from the scaffold. Her resulting autopsy found she had died from a broken neck and her death was instantaneous. Mary's body was buried within the walls of Strangeways Prison, and she lay there until rebuilding work took place sometime around 1991, which resulted in her grave being excavated. Her remains were then cremated at Blackley Cemetery at Manchester, along with other executed criminals, and all their ashes were buried within two unmarked graves, simply numbered C2710 and C2711. So was Mary responsible for the deaths of three people? Did she really poison them? And what were her motives? Was it for the insurance policies? Was it so she could be with Thomas Dixon? Perhaps it was for both. But let's not forget about Thomas in all of this. Was he complicit in all of the murders, and did he leave Mary to take all of the blame? Or was he just an innocent man who somehow found himself embroiled in all of this? Now, a lot of things both Mary and Thomas got up to does kind of make you question things, from cashing in within hours of their family members' deaths, to meeting up on a regular basis and trying not to be seen by people living within the same street, such as getting out of cabs, for example, on Henrietta Street. I guess we'll never know the truth, but in the end, history will forever show that Mary Ann Britland will be found guilty on all three counts of murder and will become the first female to be executed within Strangeways Prison. So thanks very much for listening. I hope you enjoyed this story. And if you want more, please show some support and comment down below. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram. Links are down below. But in the meantime, take care, and we'll be back very soon with another tale from the past.